Shrink Wrap Radio number 530, The Impact of Cyber Trauma on Children, with Catherine Nibbs.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with child and adult trauma therapist, Catherine Nibbs. She's the author of the 2016 Kindle book, Cyber Trauma, The Darker Side of the Internet for Children and Young People. We'll be discussing her work. For more information about Catherine Nibbs, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Once again, today's episode is sponsored by Swellbee.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice. Free and easy to use, sign up today at Swellbee.com. Now, here is the interview. Catherine Nibbs, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David, for inviting me. It's nice to speak with you.
Yeah, well, it's really good to have you here. I know that you've been a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio, I think you said, for about 5 years, and it's always wonderful when one of my listeners turns out to also be potentially a good guest, and so that's always a treat for me. Now, you've been working in the area of trauma as a trauma therapist, so tell us a bit how that came about.
It feels a little bit like a winding path that I tried to evade. So I kind of grew up with a father who worked in the prison service, and I was introduced to all kinds of stories growing up that weren't very nice. And I decided to go off and join the army, and I became an engineer. And unfortunately, I didn't have the best of marriages. And there was a lot of, I'm going to say, trauma, PTSD. And I left the army and went kind of into computers. And then I started to train as a psychotherapist. And I seem to have come full circle. And what I'm now doing is working with children who have been traumatized. But specifically, I have this little interest, which has grown and grown and grown over the last 5 or 6 years, in the area of how the internet is actually interplaying with trauma and how the two worlds seem to be overlapping.
Yeah.
So it's kind of two worlds.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Now, do you have some training as a trauma therapist, and are you seeking more training? Tell us what the picture looks like.
I am a little bit of a, I'm not even sure what word to use, but I am a little bit of a fangirl of a lot of the trauma therapists from America. So I spend a lot of time on usually via the internet. So NICABM sounds true. I have a watch of a lot of videos, read a lot of books, go to a lot of conferences. And I have quite a few favorite people who I have followed around the UK where possible. And I go to as many conferences, trainings, meetings. Yeah, anything I can get my hands on.
Okay, so you have been referring to the phenomenon of cyber trauma in terms, and as I searched for that word, it sounds like it's maybe a concept that you've kind of coined, is that right?
Yeah. In about 2012, I was actually looking, at this point in time, I was actually looking at how young adults were using Facebook, and I was interested in something called grooming, which in 2012 wasn't really a huge phenomenon at the time. And what I found myself doing was scouting Facebook and watching the behaviours of the adults and the children on there. And I kept coming across images that were really, really disturbing and some videos. And I kind of started to think back about when I first used the internet and it was on dial-up and there were some very bizarre websites. And you could only get to the websites if you knew the names. And what I was looking at was how images were being shared without that kind of consent and without that underhanded knowledge, if you like. And actually, this was more in the mainstream. And as I was actually researching for looking at grooming via Facebook, I came across quite a few images, and I kind of coined the phrase, and I've stuck with it since.
Yeah. Now, when you say grooming, you're talking about sexual predators who are kind of grooming children for some kind of personal contact. They're kind of working them towards that.
Yeah, I think at the time I was more interested in how peers were doing it to each other. So children of varying ages that weren't too dissimilar. So not really the high predator distance that's usually perceived of, you know, as the children that I would speak to would call them dirty old men. Actually, I was looking at 17, 18 and 19 year olds who were preying on 12, 13, 14 year olds.
So how would you define cyber trauma? Because as you've worked with this, it sort of has expanded.
Yeah, it started off as a simple statement, and I'm really trying to work on an academic definition that will stay, that doesn't sound like I've written it in Wikipedia, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, I'm kind of looking at cyber trauma is any trauma that is that a person will be a victim of that comes from use of or interaction with any internet-ready device, and that can be self or other-directed. And recently I've added on, and that trauma can either be present, retrospective, or delayed, which means it can happen now, in the past, and in the future.
Okay. And you've written a Kindle book, which people can find on the web about this, and which you go into a lot of detail explaining the phenomena. Mm-hmm. And you have a kind of a warning in the book, I think it was, that said that you've kind of run into a lot of resistance as you try to get other professionals interested in this phenomenon. Yeah. Maybe not just professionals, but parents and teachers and so on. And I found a little bit of that in myself, because the phenomena that you're talking about are very upsetting. They're they're about children getting sucked into something before they're ready to handle it, before they're emotionally or neurologically ready to handle it. Talk to us a bit more about the range, because it's not just Facebook, but it's also video games and what are the different settings?
Where this kind, and it really does feel both overwhelming and hugely frightening to a lot of people. And by that, I mean counsellors, teachers, anybody who's involved in the e-safety world. And what I've noticed is, I think the way to phrase this is, when we were growing up, and I mean anybody over about the age of 25, 30, when we wanted to enter into a world that was 18 plus, we needed to be nearly 18 or look 18, or, you know, we couldn't go uptown and get into a nightclub until you looked around about the age that would mean that you could get into it.
Yeah.
And what the internet has provided is this level of ability of any child to enter into an 18 plus world.
Yeah.
And it's the 18 plus world that contains material that, you know, people are. I suppose their brain isn't ready for the impact of that world. And childhood seems to be losing some of the essence. And I think the frightening thing is where I'm bringing this to the forefront and saying to people, these are the kind of issues that can appear, and these are the forms and the platforms and the ways in which it can happen.
Yeah.
A lot of people are quite terrified. And it's, I suppose, the same for trauma per se, that we don't want to go and we don't want to look at, and we don't want to witness or feel that kind of impact.
Right. My kids are grown at this point, but I would shudder if I were bringing them up now. And I do have young grandkids, and the parents, one set of my grandkid parents, are very leery. The kids are not getting any exposure, partly because of a school that they go to where it's maybe overprotective, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I hear, you know, I guess there are two main things to be concerned about here. One is premature sexual exposure to sexual, not just quotes normal sexuality, but very extreme expressions of sexuality that can be found online. And then the other has to do with violence and the violence that can be found, particularly in video games. And I sort of, I don't play video games, but when I get a glimpse of some of the things that are out there, it's absolutely shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to be honest, David, I don't think it's just limited to computer games. So one of the things that I'm really interested in at the moment is how, over the last 10 years, we've changed our level of what we feel is appropriate for horror movies and the what appears on television and in the media. So that it seems that because the bar has been raised by videos, television programs, that actually the games are following suit. The difference, I feel, is the distinction between passive and active involvement in something like that. So using computer games, children are more actively engaged rather than sitting back and passively watching.
Right.
So I think there's, at the moment I'm writing a paper on the differences between kind of how children are affected by the internet. And I'm really interested in the exposure and the type of exposure. So whether it's cognitively active or whether people are sat back and viewing something passively and whether that has a distinct effect.
Yeah, yeah. So are you currently seeing people in therapy? Are you in fact working with people who seem to be traumatized? Because you're using that word trauma.
Yeah, currently I would say it's more late adolescent, early adulthood that I'm dealing with, and there's the impact of the trauma that I'm seeing at the moment is related to pornography use and impotence and erectile dysfunction and lack of interpersonal relationships at home, because people are using words such as addicted or stalking, and they're not actually the same as the academic definitions. And what people are saying is, so one of the phrases people will use is Facebook stalking. And what that means is to view somebody else's Facebook profile. But it doesn't mean stalking in the same sense that it would do in law or in academic terms.
Right. But what does it mean in terms of the Facebook world? Somebody who is constantly sending messages to that are undesired to somebody?
It could be. So I think in the book I talk about one kind of cyberbullying is the constant liking of posts or disliking of or putting comments on. So it's that presence, that virtual presence that you're in somebody's virtual space. But also it can mean quite voyeuristic. So if somebody was to have a look at your Facebook profile or your Instagram profile, maybe even follow you on Twitter in a public platform like that, actually you don't necessarily know that somebody is doing that. So it can be quite voyeuristic stalking.
I see. You might not be aware of it.
Yeah.
Although at some point maybe you would become aware of it, and then that would be very upsetting.
Yeah, I think so. And looking at some of the research that was done in this country around online stalking, I'm trying to think of what the figures were, but it was quite high that there were more people presenting with PTSD symptoms who had been stalked online than they were in real life, because there's this almost never-ending presence. And the world that we now all inhabit is computer-based, and you know, whether we like it or not, we are all connected to this internet, because now organizations such as banks, schools, colleges, they all use the internet. So, right. So as much as people don't want to be involved with it, it's actually become the narrative. So one of my clients who is in her 70s actually says, and I don't have Facebook. So it's already in her narrative to not have Facebook. And she's now trying to learn Facebook. Hmm. Whereas I don't think this would have appeared in any therapy room 20 years ago, this discussion about this other world, in inverted commas.
Yeah. And of course, I guess cyberbullying would fall into this realm as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've just worked on a paper with somebody else about the term cyberbullying, because again, it's another term that it doesn't have a good enough definition, and I believe that the UN have said it's one of the things that they wanted a definition of. I'm actually suggesting that it's a phenomena, because there are so many variances, typologies, there's so many nuanced ways of cyber bully or cyber harassment or cyber trolling or cyber stalking, and there's just so many domains that are coming up, and depending on when the word was defined in the first instance has also changed. So the word trolling has actually changed over the last 5 years to mean something slightly different to what it originally did.
Trolling.
Yeah.
I've just started to see that word. And so what does that mean? A person is a troll is by...
I think it may end up being quite a bit of a psychopathological framework that we start to apply to people and the way that they behave on the internet or otherwise. But it's really interesting that trolling used to mean somebody who would cause discord. So they would come in on a chat group, they'd say something that had nothing to do with the conversation, and then they would basically step back and watch the melee of people who would get very angry and start arguing. But now it means to constantly be hassling or harassing somebody. So in the idea, this would also fit under the term of cyberbullying.
Okay.
So kind of everything is now becoming quite enmeshed.
And we do know, I believe, that there are instances where cyberbullying has led to suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and quite a lot of the platforms, such as Ask.fm and Facebook, and all have now started to put anti-cyberbullying techniques into place and to try and limit the number of instances where this occurs. I kind of feel like it's a little bit too late, because this has now grown exponentially. But also it's very difficult to monitor cyberbullying when there are so many different forms of it, as there are in the real world, the varying types of bullying or the varying types of abuse.
Yeah. So what inspired you to write your book?
Basically, because I'm a busy person, David, and I looked at the fact that I had to get this this dual master's done, and I'd got to get a few other things done, and I basically looked at, I need to get it written around about now, which happened to have been just over the Christmas period through to February this year. And I wanted to bring it out for something called Safer Internet Day, which occurs in the United Kingdom, and lots of people are really interested in promoting Safer Internet Days. And to be perfectly honest, I went with self-publishing, so I've done it where you can buy it in a paper format as well, so it's printed to order. And I literally went with it to kind of get it from inside, where there was a lot of information, to the outside. And I think a month after I'd written the book, I've now come up with another set of issues. So there's going to be some form of second, third and fourth edition. And I think that's the way that this cyber world will continue to grow.
Sure.
And we will see it in more and more therapy rooms.
What about the word trauma? Is there any chance that the word is being over-applied here?
It is insofar as I kind of put two words together and said, okay, so this is when somebody has been traumatized by the internet. And actually, what I could be looking at is when somebody has been harassed by it. So again, even my language may not fit. And what is traumatizing for one child may not be traumatizing for another child, and the same for the adults. I've kind of come up with what I'm going to call a theoretical framework, and it's a very small percentage of people who are actually traumatized by something that has happened on the internet. I think we could call it cyber affected, cyber, we could notice things off the internet. There's a lot to be said about that. I dived in and came up with this word in 2012.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it's evolving, it's nebulous, it's also ambiguous. And I'm aware of that, which is where I'm trying to refine it.
Yeah. It seems to me you ought to be in a PhD program somewhere.
I'm perhaps at the end of this, at the end of this interview, somebody will get in contact. I have said, I think I have enough of this theory to put it down on paper and do something like that. And I do have a real interest in the impact of graphic media. I'm really, really interested in what that is actually doing to, for example, the levels of cortisol, the desensitization that we keep. So the media uses this word a lot. So we're desensitized to violence, and I'm not sure that we are actually desensitized. I'd really like to look into that. And I'm also really interested in the discussion that we had earlier about grooming. There is a trend, according to some of the research in this country that's beginning at the moment, that younger people are kind of trolling, winding up, harassing older people in the world of the online dating. And I'm really interested in why children would be doing that. Because it's not an arena children have ever entered into before.
Well, in a way, what comes to mind are practical jokes. When I was a kid, you know, you sort of, if you could get one over on an adult, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
It was funny and exciting to be a prankster. So I think in a way it's kind of part of childhood to want to do that.
I think my interest is more in the sexualized area. So, and this is where children are making the mistakes of sexting and sending quite explicit prose and videos and images. And that's what I'm interested in, because I suppose that's a new behavior, or perhaps we've never been able to monitor this before. And now that something's digital, we do have a way of kind of going back and retracing and having a look at the evidence and being able to weigh it up. It just seems to be an ever-evolving area. And again, in about 6 months, I'll probably have a different idea that I'd like to go off and have a look at.
Yeah, I can. It is a rapidly moving area. And as the technology changes, that will present new challenges. For example, virtual reality, which is just starting to come on. Virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and both of these are going to create new challenges, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually involved with a company from Switzerland at the moment who have developed an AI chatbot kind of app that works with children, younger children at the moment, so between the ages of about 7 to 12, to help them navigate the online world. And what it does is it works with the child and helps them gain autonomy, agency, learn to develop values, so that we can actually have the cohort of younger children coming through and being able to navigate and think before they actually engage in a behaviour. Because I think that's the error, if you like. That's the error that we're catching up on, and that's where the word cyber trauma came from for me, really, was the fact that children do make it, instead of adults, but children make errors, and those errors become permanent. Yeah.
We had grandkids over just yesterday watching Pippi Longstocking's film, and so it was interesting to see my 8-year-old granddaughter, who's not exposed to a lot of media, so this was a big deal to come to our house and watch Pippi Longstockings. And the plot of Pippi Longstockings actually involves playing tricks on parents and playing tricks on other adults and running away from home, being independent. And it was interesting to watch the body language of my granddaughter, who was so completely caught up and enmeshed in this video, you know, where her whole body was moving and she'd get very excited. So definitely there's something fairly powerful going on in terms of a learning experience, of a shaping the brain experience.
And I've kind of drawn on, so a lot of where I'm thinking at the moment, I've drawn a lot on Dan Siegel's work, Stephen Porges, Bessel van der Kolk, and I'm looking at actually how the body is kind of becoming involved. So one of the interesting things that I'm writing at the moment is about how the distance at which devices are used really seems to be kind of implicitly involved in the attachment system. So I can't even remember how this happened. I think I was presenting at a conference, and I happened to have been holding the paper at about 30 centimetres, which is the general distance that most of us have a book.
Okay.
And I had this moment where I thought, hang on a minute, this is the distance at which devices are held, and we use our hands and our brains and our eyes, and there's this whole enmeshment in whether it's a device that you're looking at in your hand, the distance to which you're holding a device and you're looking at the screen. So children tend to go towards screens.
Yeah, we have to tell them to step back. Yeah. They would, if you let them, they would stand with their hands on the TV set.
Yeah, and I kind of looked at that, and I'm really into, I'm not even sure how. I'm trying to explain that this must be the attachment, an implicit attachment system that must be tapping into something within the body. And I'm kind of thinking along the polyvagal theory that it might be about the communication system and how we're actually connecting. Because the narrative that a lot of younger clients use is that this means that they're talking to somebody. So younger children don't see. So, for example, I'm talking to you on a screen at the moment, and I know there's four edges to the screen, and I'm using a computer program to talk to you. And by the wonders of technology, you could be halfway around the world, and I can have a real-time conversation. Younger children are actually experiencing this as though you are in the room. Mm-hmm. And the narrative seems to miss out that there's this corporeal distance, and they're actually attributing the person is in the room with me, or if they're holding their device, they're talking about the person, they're talking to the person. And I'm finding that really fascinating, that there's some way that we are really becoming immersed with this technology. And I see that virtual reality is going to take it to the next level. And we've got augmented reality. We've also got new technology at the moment. I was watching something on Upworthy the other day about skin that will actually breathe in time with data. So this skin will actually sit on top of your skin. And as you're watching something, so it might be a piece of music, the skin will actually move in time with the music. And I thought this is really becoming interesting now, because we've gone from passive and visual to actually active and involved, but cognitively and somatically.
Right.
So we're moving forward, I think, again, at a speed where I suppose as therapists and as people watching children growing up in this world, it's going to feel very alien. It's going to sound, you know, pretty much science fiction. And I just find that really, really interesting.
Yeah. Now, there is a literature out there, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I would think that it would be important for you to get involved in that literature, of a lot of research on the effects of violence and movies, TV, mm-hmm. on kids.
Yeah. If I think that, is it the two film, Anderson and Bushman did a lot, and I drew a lot on their kind of violence and how, and under the social learning theories, I suppose, how watching, so this goes all the way back to Bandura's, watching the Bobo doll, and actually how children can watch and then mimic. And I think that's what, I suppose the media has more of a slant on it and says, you know, babies should not watch TV. Children are becoming violent because they're playing violent games. And actually, I'm not necessarily seeing that all of the time. And I suppose it depends on the narrative that goes with the child's experience. So whether parents are available to say, well, actually, that's not a very nice thing to do, or that doesn't feel okay, and the discussions around empathy.
Yeah. So it sounds like you are seeing children, you're seeing people now. Can you tell us something about how these issues are manifesting in their lives, or how they manifest in the consulting room when you're talking with them?
I think the one that seems to be the easiest to kind of talk about, insofar as the internet has this, I can't say effect, because there's no cause effect, it's very corollary. But I have seen over the past 5 or 6 years a number of children who have been cyberbullied, and they've actually come into the room and said, yes, I got cyberbullied, and what happened was, this girl said this, then this happened, then this happened. And because I was so upset and I couldn't get rid of the image, I then decided to self-harm and I would cut. And one client actually then used the internet to learn how to self-harm at a higher level. And what she did was she discussed with me how she'd used some of the self-harm forums to learn how to self-harm. And unfortunately, she misconstrued a piece of information about the healing of scars. And what she actually did was she used vegetable oil because she'd heard of a particular oil for getting rid of scars. And she'd misattributed what she was supposed to use. And she ended up with an infection in her sores and had to go to hospital. And that became the kind of conversation that we had in the therapy room about how cyberbullying had led to this demise of self-esteem, but it had also led to this escalation of behavior.
So this is shocking to me to learn that there are forums that people or kids go to learn how to self-harm. Mm-hmm. What, to learn how to cut themselves or burn themselves with cigarettes or what?
Yeah, there's varying degrees of it, David. And again, this is where it begins to sound quite frightening, but there are forums. I know that the internet is a provision of free speech. So as much as people do try to look after the world of e-safety and they say, right, we're going to get rid of this for it, they tend to change and pop up all over. And trends like this appear on some of the platforms such as Tumblr and Instagram. And what children will do if they know that these forums are being tracked or changed, they will start to change the language that they're using to keep it hidden. So there are a lot of sites that exist around eating disorders, eating disorders, self-harm, all the way through to something called self-mutilation, which is really horrific. And it's young girls. And what we do know from something called the dark net is that also people who are not who they say they are will basically spend a lot of their day surfing the internet, going onto these websites and actually taunting and teasing and providing bad information to the youngsters and adults that are out there. So there's varying degrees of the internet, then the dark web, then the dark net.
Wow.
So levels at which people can actually communicate with each other via these systems.
Yeah, I've been hearing about the dark web and the dark net. It's been showing up, I guess, in some crime fiction, TV dramas, book dramas, and so on, and which I suppose, as it gets exposed, also gets more people interested in it and wanting to find out, oh, how can I do that?
Yeah. And I'm going to say that it's actually the adolescents. I'm not going to put it in the younger end at the moment because I haven't heard it. But the adolescents do tend to talk about these areas, and they do know about the dark net and they do know about the deep web. And quite often they say, oh, you don't want to go there, Kath, it's sick, meaning it's really horrible and vile. And quite often I'll say, have you been on it? And they say, well, I know how to get on it, but I know what's on there. So perhaps children do have this implicit knowledge about, actually, that's a bit too much, too far.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Actually, that brings up another point about resilience and attachment styles. So I think a lot of material at the moment in this country actually says that children are resilient on the internet. And I do believe that. I think the internet is a wonderful place. It allows for moments like this where, you know, people can share their knowledge and it's fantastic. But I think children who are not resilient, who do not have secure attachment, are more at risk and more likely to follow through with the risk-taking behaviours. And it also falls in line with what Dan Siegel calls hyper-rational thinking. So it is a normal part of child development to risk take. The internet provides that platform at a bigger, it's much, much bigger for children to actually go into that domain and that environment and actually try things out.
What was that word that you use that Dan Siegel uses? What
kind of hyper-rational thinking.
Spell it for me.
H-Y-P-E-R.
Hyper-rational.
Hyper-rational, yeah.
And what's that meant? What does that mean, hyper-rational? I haven't run across that.
In adolescent brain changes, the way that children assess what's safe and unsafe is usually done, I think the best way to explain it is on odds and probability. So where I wouldn't drive down the road at 90 miles an hour, because I might hit somebody and I might kill them. So I've kind of thought about the consequences in advance. An adolescent may drive at a high speed because there's not much chance of it happening. So they would think in a very different way to an adult.
Okay.
And it's about executive functioning. It's about planned planning consequences, delayed gratification.
Yeah. You early in the conversation, you said something about the addictive possibilities or potentials. Talk about that a bit. Do you see that there's addictive potential, addictive behavior around the issues that we're talking about?
I'm kind of in two feet in two camps at the moment about whether it is addiction or whether it's an interpersonal attachment. So I quite often see, for example, a young man who decided to speak to a prostitute via a sex site, and actually he was on this sex site every single day. So if you'd have looked at his history, he used the word addicted, actually. And he actually said, you know, and I speak to this lady every day because I'm addicted to using the site. And I said, what is it that you use it for? And the narrative was around he wanted to understand what a relationship with a woman would be like before going out and trying it in the real world. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem to fit under the characteristics of addictive personality disorders or addictive behavior if we were to look at the DSM-5. Mm-hmm. And what I was seeing was something that looked like interpersonal relationships. It seemed more about attachment than it actually did addiction. However, he would not speak to this woman. And he'd actually said, you know, I can't not go a day without speaking to her. And much to the detriment of whatever his lifestyle was, he was having this conversation near enough the same time every day with this lady, which kind of looks like addiction when he is continuing to do something that's detrimental to. So it sits under both camps. And I suppose the motivation behind somebody's intent and what they are actually engaged in and with can be the difference between attachment and addiction. I think that's how I'm seeing it.
Yeah, it can be difficult to separate. I was thinking another thing to look at is it disruptive or harmful in their life and their development? And this one that you're describing certainly potentially sounds like it could be, because it could get in the way of establishing real relationships with real women.
Yeah.
Become kind of a crutch.
Yeah. It's just brought to mind, actually, one of the ladies that I was seeing that used it really to release anxiety. So actually she was finding the real world difficult to deal with. So to release her anxiety, she would go on the internet. Mm-hmm. And the phrase she used is she would numb out. And what she would do is she'd go on shopping channels, she'd go on social media, she'd go, I don't know, onto YouTube. She was just finding something to do to release the anxiety of struggling in the real world.
Yeah.
And that was detrimental to because what she then wasn't doing was looking after her children. She wasn't being in a relationship with her husband. And she'd replaced that real world behavior with the virtual. But it was done to release anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So again, it falls under different categories. And I suppose this is the issue with the cyberspace, is where we actually define stuff. So I think this is where I'm struggling with some of the psychology and, I suppose, psychotherapy theories that talk about this is how, for example, attachment happens. And I think, well, actually, when it comes to the virtual world, it can be done in a slightly different way. Hmm. Or up until now, every kind of psychotherapy treatment is based on people being in a room. And we've now developed into this online therapy.
Right.
So there's tiny little nuances all the way throughout the theories and the development of them at the moment.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I keep thinking about. I'm really impressed by your thinking, and how you're able to tie it to other things that are going on in psychology and psychotherapy, and really want to see you get allied either by being a doctoral student or finding some way to be allied with somebody who has the experience and the credibility to help you advance your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, because I think you have the potential here to be a real pioneer in this area.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was a lovely compliment. Thank you. Yeah. I'm just going to have a moment and I'm going to bask in that. So
yeah, right. Well, you should. So how do people find you to work with their issues? It sounds like you're seeing people. How do they know about you?
Yeah, it's been a very strange thing. In therapy, I suppose, in the country, quite often you have to register yourself on the governing body's websites. And so I did find that's how I started off as a therapist. And what is happening now is, if there is a cyber related, it's really interesting. Whenever somebody emails me now, they put the word cyber in inverted commas. So it might be, hi, Kath, there is a child who, or there is a person who, or there is an adult who.
Yeah, I have a friend who, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it seems to be, and they've used the internet. I don't know whether you'd be interested, but the other interesting thing is, even when it's not a presenting issue, it soon becomes part of the narrative in the therapy room. Mm-hmm. So children will start to, for example, when I was working a couple of weeks ago, there was a domestic abuse issue, and the child came in, and it turned out it wasn't a domestic abuse issue per se. It was the fact that the dad was showing the child the beheading videos because he wanted him to become radicalized, and that was the child's issue. So it wasn't the fact that the family had been domestic abuse. It turned out that the child was absolutely terrified because he thought he needed to watch these videos, and he was terrified of them. But also, he didn't know how to get the images out of his head. So that was something that I actually sat as an advisor with somebody on, rather than seeing the child. So it's really interesting how I see it appearing in other realms. So I quite often get asked, you know, Kath, can I just have some of you thinking on this? So there are some practitioners that will phone up and ask if I can just give them a bit of a consultancy or advice, which I don't mind, because I'm really interested in, actually, this helps me develop going forward. And the opposite happens when it comes to actually teaching about it. It's a very resistant topic at the moment, because I'm not talking about e-safety. I'm actually talking about, this is what can happen, this is the impact, and this is how you can help. And it's, yeah.
How old was this child who was being forced to watch beheadings?
They were about 9 or 10. They were about 9 or 10, yeah. Huh. Yeah, and obviously I don't know what the videos were. I didn't ask, because it's really interesting. I happen to be talking about something that I'm passionate about. But even hearing about I can't hear about the videos because it makes me feel really sick. So I have, you know, there's an over-empathy, and I don't want to know the content. I just want to know, you know, what is happening to people, and what, I'm really interested in why people are watching these things, why they're engaging in this behavior. There's a lot of why and curiosity, and that's where it's coming from at the moment.
You know, there's a dynamic that's been referred to as counterphobia, where we may be drawn to the things that we're afraid of as an attempt to master the fear. And so supposedly that's why children like to be thrown up into the air, or why we get on roller coasters and things like that, is we're trying to toughen ourselves up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be something that particularly young people can be drawn into activities that they are afraid of, or that they know they shouldn't go there, but there's that temptation to think, well, you know, if I go there, I'll be stronger.
Actually, that's another, and I've just sparked off on another tangent. That is something that I'm had noticed. So I worked a lot with sexual abuse at one of my recent jobs. I've left there. And I do still work with sexual abuse, but what one or two of the adolescents were actually taking their level of fear to kind of horror movies, but then moving it up into something that's called a snuff movie. And that what they were doing was watching things that were so horrific that they were kind of I think if you look at the kind of window of tolerance, what these children were doing was trying to peak really far out to come back down, mm-hmm. because their baseline levels were so high set on the window of tolerance, that I think what they were doing was trying to get a really big kick so that they could then come back down, because that's where we get the relief from, isn't it? When you've had your peak and then you return back to normal. And I think perhaps there was an element of, I can control this because it's a video I put on. And I asked, you know, so how do you watch these videos? And the response was, well, I turned the sound down. And I said, and what does that do? And they said, well, it just means that I can watch it. And if I can watch it, then I can go back and I can watch it with sound because I know it's tolerable. Or I will skip through the video and then go back to the beginning and watch it. Mm. And I thought, wow, that's both clever, and it also gives these children a limit to which they can go, okay, I can tolerate this, whereas life can be intolerable.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how children will find basically resilience, isn't it? They're finding where their resilience will actually stretch to and taking it to that limit, and sometimes just a little bit beyond, in order to control it.
Yeah, that takes me back to video games, and so many of these video games, the child is actually enacting the role of a killer or a criminal, and they're deliberately crashing cars and shooting people and stabbing people, doing and. So I don't know how much we know about how much separation there is, particularly related to age and so on, between seeing something act. And the graphics keep getting better and better, right?
I think for me, the interesting thing, so I watched a program the other day called How to Make a Human. The capabilities we now have with computer-generated images they are matching almost real faces, real life. And I think there must be something about cognitive development. And for me, I'm thinking about the Piaget's stages, about what they can differentiate between what is real and what is not real. Because I listen to children's stories about being frightened of Tom and Jerry cartoons or Scooby-Doo cartoons. And when you look at 3 and 4 year olds being frightened of a cartoon, I think, well, what must some of these images look like? And I think in the book I talked about the little boy who had watched one of the computer games with a zombie in it, and he was absolutely terrified. And this is going all the way back to, must be 2011. So it's 5 years ago, and actually he was terrified by something he's seen then. And now the computer games graphics they fool me at times. And if you think about big film productions by Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, you're looking at really, really good technology.
Right.
To the point that even adults are being fooled by the graphics.
Yeah. Yeah, in those movies today, you know, armies of orcs and so on. You know, there's not really an army of orcs there, but they've been rendered in such realistic ways that, and I think sometimes in crowd scenes, they're doing crowd scenes now that maybe aren't real people.
It saves a lot on the buying lots of extras in for films, doesn't it? But actually, it goes to show that.
Yeah.
I think I heard a statistic the other day that. Within the next 5 years, 6% of the world's jobs will be taken over by computers or technology.
Yeah.
I thought that is it is quite a huge figure. Although it doesn't sound a lot, 6%, that's 6% of jobs that are now automated.
Right, right.
So we have things called chatbots. So, you know, if you were to, I'm sure Amazon use them and eBay and places like that, big corporations, and they have what looks like somebody talking to you via text, and it's an artificial intelligence robot.
Huh. I want to look into that some more. I saw a reference that I meant to follow up on about what was supposed to be a really good chat bot that you could interact with to learn about chat bots. if you have any links like that, send it to me, because
it's
an area I'm very curious about. You know, there used to be this sort of Rogerian therapist online that you could interact with, but and that was before the term bot or chat bot was around, and I'm forgetting the name of it now. And, you know, it would say simple things like, tell me more about that, and how does that make you feel, and so on. But very quickly, you would figure out, okay, it's kind of stuck and it's very limited. But I gather it's really been pushed quite a bit further now.
Yeah, I was looking at, I was reading Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity in 2006 when I was doing my undergrad degree. So I was looking into artificial intelligence, and actually that's where I intended my studies to go in 2006.
Uh-huh.
And I've kind of gone off in a bit of a, like I was saying earlier, I've gone off in a bit of a loop.
Yeah.
Actually, what I've ended up doing is psychotherapy with computers and how it's kind of affecting people. So I think it's really interesting that I've actually got hold of, and I use heart rate variability software. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is how the kind of games that I've got may well affect a person's ability to regulate their emotions, but also their physiological state. And I'm going to start putting I'm going to call it a tagline or a hashtag, and go technology for trauma, because actually that's where I'm heading at the moment.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it's all kind of enmeshed for me in the directions that I've chosen as to why I've ended up where I have. I'm doing what I'm doing.
One of the interviews I did years ago now, his name is Skip Rizzo, a psychologist at the University of Southern California, who was using virtual reality things to work with veterans with suffering from trauma, so that he could put them back into the scene and then have them practice deep breathing and self-regulation and so on.
Yeah.
So there's work like that that's already happening. And I'm sure there's a lot of room for more development.
Yeah, and I know of, so I was watching something that was almost holographic. So I think it was years ago, you could have a holographic meeting around a table and people would be kind of shone into the room so that one person existed and the rest of the room was holograms. I've seen this kind of technology where you can take yourself into a virtual space. It looks very reminiscent of Second Life and that world. It looks like you're actually in the room with your therapist virtually, which I look at people who have social anxiety, depression, who can't actually get out. Actually, that would be a wonderful way for them to begin a therapy session, being able to actually visit their therapist virtually, you know, and sit on the couch with them and experience what therapy is without having to kind of overcome the first stages of going out of the house.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've been talking about some scary things. What would your advice to parents be? I gather you're not a parent at this point?
No, I am. I am a parent. I have a 20-year-old and an 18-year-old. So a lot of my learning came from.
I'm shocked. You look so youthful.
Yes, it's all the graphics.
Great graphics.
I have two boys, and a lot of this interest came from watching them grow up in this world. So I actually monitored what my children did whilst they were growing. Apparently, I'm a pest because I'm constantly saying, "What's that? How does that work? How does this work?"
Yeah.
And my children constantly send me videos, send me links. Have you heard about this? Do you know about this? This is what's happening.
Uh-huh. So they keep you plugged in. So what is your advice to parents of young kids?
The best piece of advice I have is really get involved with what your children are doing on their devices. Regularly be curious. Don't be nosy, and there's a difference. So I try to explain to parents that if you ask genuinely curious questions about, well, what's that app? What does it do? How do you talk to people? Children invariably like to show you what they know. So we're back to that. Not so much trickery, but children really do like to say, well, actually, this is what it is and this is what it does. But get hold of a phone or device or whatever it is the child's using and put the same programs on and learn to navigate them, so that you can have conversations with your children, because the deficit that exists between education and parenting is the one that's being exploited. So I would say if you can become a parent who understands the technology with your children, you have a better, I want to say chance, but it doesn't feel the right word. You have a better way of working with your child as they grow with technology, which they will. And one of the words that you hear regularly is, I'm not tech savvy. And I say to parents, so get tech savvy.
Yeah.
It's almost a must.
That's a good point. It makes me think that there need to be courses out there for parents.
They exist insofar as there are lots and lots of beforehand. And I know in this country, lots and lots of schools put on e-safety days and they have parent classes. And the issue with that is not many parents turn up because that. How can I put this? There is a cohort at the minute of children who have grown up without being given the right kind of tools to navigate the online world. I think the children that are coming into using this technology now, so 2, 3, and 4-year-olds, are actually going to move through time with parents who have an interest. What seems to be the deficit is around about 8 or 9 to about 25, 26. So the first children ever to enter into the internet-ready world.
Yeah.
They seem to have been given this it's almost Atlas on their shoulders, and they've tried to navigate this world in the best way that they know how, and carried out normal childhood behaviours using a platform that will actually it provide them with lots and lots of mistakes and lots of learning curves and lots of ways of improving. However, that is going to, I think what's going to happen is this shift in time is just going to stay with those children. So I think at the moment parents are, I think the media over here says they're waking up to technology, but that's what I would say is really get tech savvy.
Maybe this is what you're saying in part, is that young parents today are among those who have grown up with technology. Oh. So they're a lot less likely to be intimidated by it and maybe will be able to more easily navigate some of these issues.
Yeah. And actually, these are the children who, and parents now, who are going to be the entrepreneurs and the designers of the technology for the next generation of children.
Yeah.
So it no longer do we have the nerds and the geeks who are computer savvy people and those of us who just milled about and it's kind of that them and us. Now there is this almost everybody's tech savvy because there's pieces of research showing that 69% of all households in the United Kingdom own a tablet, whether children have access to it. But that is a really big figure, 69%.
On a tablet or a computer?
In the household that there is a tablet present. Unfortunately, David, our generation uses computers and the new generation use tablets.
Yeah, supposedly we're moving away. I have an iMac here, which I totally love, and I can't imagine having to go to something smaller. But
yes, I am. That's a very interesting fact, actually. Many of my male friends all have big screens at home. So when we talk about going to tablets and everything, they will say things like, "Yeah, but if you're watching a film, it has to be on a big screen." So it's almost as though they don't want to get rid of the big screen.
Yeah.
And I also like my Apple products, and I can't see me moving away from a computer because there's something about sitting at a desk which feels almost academic, and playing on an iPad feels almost like I'm lounging around in my pajamas.
Yeah, interesting.
They feel very different.
Yeah, interesting. As we wind down here, is there anything more that you'd like to say to leave our audience with?
I suppose that this is an area that is going to become one that people will encounter. I don't think it's going to affect every single child or adult who enters into the internet realm. It is a very small percentage. When I talk about cyber trauma, I am talking a small percentage of children. And I think what we need to do is actually start to understand that children are engaging in behaviour, and it's not because they are bad children or naughty children or doing things to shock people. It's because they're experimenting, and we are far behind the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the implications of the behaviours and the mistakes are something that we're going to be kind of working with I don't want to say cleaning up, but we're going to be working with for the next 20, 30, maybe 40 years. And actually, there's a big difference between when I made a mistake and it's not returned. There's no way people can see what I said or did 20 years ago without having a photograph. And actually, somebody would have to have that physical photograph now to say, oh, do you remember, you know, when you dressed up like this in the 1970s looking like a punk, or you did so-and-so, so-and-so. It's very different now. Mistakes are more permanent.
Well, that's a great wrap-up. Catherine Nibbs, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
As you heard, I think Catherine Nibbs is doing some pioneering work by focusing on the potentially traumatizing effects of the cyber world on youngsters, not to mention the rest of us. I've found for myself that it's possible to see things on the internet that you wish you had never seen. Imagine how much more impactful online images, experiences, and relationships are for very young minds, very young nervous systems. I'm impressed by the way Catherine is working to integrate psychological theory and research with her intuitions about this emerging area of concern. I hope she can find some academics who will help champion and guide her work, whether that be in the context of a doctoral program or otherwise. You can find her 2016 Kindle book, Cyber Trauma, The Darker Side of the Internet for Children and Young People, using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
I have a confession to make. I am a Shrink Wrap Radio addict. That's right. Dr. Dave has me totally hooked. I am devouring episode after episode, so I figured it's only fair to make a donation. And, you know, if you're enjoying these shows too, perhaps you should think about making a donation, maybe even just a one-off one. Every little bit helps. Go on, you know it'll make you feel good.
Thank you, Louise Callanan. Yes, it will make you feel good. At least that's what I've heard from others who have done so. And it will make me feel good as well. If you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Louise as a donor. Well, I said I might be missing an episode or two due to my need to travel to my son Matthew's wedding in upstate New York. This is one of the episodes I thought I might not get out. I had vowed not to be so compulsive about this work, but here we are with another one anyway. At your service, as usual. Once again, I'd like to thank Swellbee.com for sponsoring this episode. Swellbee.com is a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers. There are other sites on the web, such as Psychology Today, where psychologists and marriage family therapists and such can list their services. The distinctive thing about Swellbee.com is the broad range of practitioners that can list there. For example, they're open to listings by acupuncturists, art therapists, audiologists, chiropractors, doulas, lactation consultants, life coaches, massage therapists, mental health therapists, midwives, nutritionists, dietitians, occupational therapists, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, speech therapists. And I'm sure we could add to that list, for example, yoga therapists, naturopaths, and many more that I'm not thinking of right now. So if you're a mental health therapist or healthcare or alternative practitioner, Swellbee was created with your practice in mind. You know, over 70% of patients and clients start their provider search online. Today, it's crucial for a healthcare practice to have a strong digital footprint, positive patient ratings, and tools to help automate manual tasks. So Swellbee built a marketing platform to accelerate new patient acquisition, increase patient engagement, and drastically reduce the burden on internal resources. Their goal is simple: help providers save time, increase revenue, and improve the overall patient experience. Patients can quickly find your profile online after you join Swellbee's marketplace of verified health and wellness professions. Again, for a limited time, they are offering this service for free. So please head to their website now and sign up at www.swellbee.com. And Swellbee is spelled S-W-E-L-L-B-Y. Finally, let me insert one more promo here. And, of course, it's for my favorite audiobook service, which is audible.com. My recommendation this week is for the book Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging by Sebastian Junger. I'm trying to get him as a guest on the show, but his publicist got back to me saying he's so swamped now with interviews and appearances that I might have better luck if I try again some months down the road. If the name Sebastian Junger sounds familiar, it's because he's an American journalist, author, and filmmaker, most famous for the best-selling book The Perfect Storm, a true story of men against the sea, which was also made into a movie. His award-winning chronicle of the war in Afghanistan in the documentary films Restrepo in 2010 and Coronagle in 2014 and his 2010 book War. You'll find Tribe on audible.com, and it's read by Sebastian Junger himself as well. Here's a short sample.
Introduction. In the fall of 1986, just out of college, I set out to hitchhike across the northwestern part of the United States. I'd hardly ever been west of the Hudson River, and in my mind, what waited for me out in Dakota and Wyoming and Montana was not only the real America, but the real me as well. I'd grown up in a Boston suburb where people's homes were set behind deep hedges or protected by huge yards, and neighbors hardly knew each other. And they didn't need to. Nothing ever happened in my town that required anything close to a collective effort. Anything bad that happened was taken care of by the police, or the fire department, or at the very least the town maintenance crews. I worked for them one summer. I remember shoveling a little too hard one day, and the foreman telling me to slow down because, as he said, some of us have to get through a lifetime of this. The sheer predictability of life in an American suburb left me hoping, somewhat irresponsibly, for a hurricane or a tornado or something that would require us all to band together to survive. Something that would make us feel like a tribe. What I wanted wasn't destruction and mayhem, but the opposite, solidarity. I wanted the chance to prove my worth to my community and my peers, but I lived in a time and a place where nothing dangerous ever really happened. Surely this was new in the human experience, I thought. How do you become an adult in a society that doesn't ask for sacrifice? How do you become a man in a world that doesn't require courage?
So, if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And, of course, if this one's not to your taste, they now have more than 250,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is Dr. John C. Robinson, author of What Aging Men Want, Homer's Odyssey. It's a parable of male aging, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, John C. Robinson, who was my guest just an episode or two ago. I'm going to skip the reading of listener emails and go straight to wrapping it up today. So, as always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Catherine Nibbs, for sharing her explorations in the new area of cyber trauma. My next interview will be with listener Jane Hart, who has courageously volunteered to come forward to share her experience of multiple personalities as someone with dissociative identity disorder. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.